Hi, everybody. Hope everybody's doing okay. I gave a long talk in the Cognitive Science Center today, so I'm a little sore. So let's see. So I'm gonna try to wrap up some of the probability theory stuff we talked about last time, and maybe get up to the halting problem today. We'll see how that goes. It might bleed off a little bit into Wednesday. I also owe you. So let's see. Next Wednesday. In addition to being a very special day, will also be Halloween. No, in addition to being a special day, will also be our midterm. And what I'd like to do, what I'd like to have done, but have not yet done, is to give you a sample midterm with 10 example questions of exactly the types that I'll have on the midterm, so you can see what those are about, and you can look at them and make sure that you can do all of them. If you can't do them, then you should definitely ask questions, and we make sure that that we'll be ready to nail those questions. All right. So, one thing that I noticed reading the newspaper the other day is this, or I guess online, New York Times stuff. So, John Markoff. So I met him, when did I meet him? I met him in Vancouver recently because he covered the human versus computer poker tournament, and I was the ref, which didn't really give me much to do, but it was kind of sort of fun, and there was a lot of, like, reporters from all over the place came, and they were really interesting to talk to. Anyway, John Markoff seems like a nice guy. Anyway, so he wrote this, I guess, blog entry about Web 3.0, because, you know, 2.0 apparently now is old hat. And I had no idea what Web 3.0 meant, so I read his little entry, and it's still not quite clear what it means. Maybe it's the semantic web, but they've been talking about the semantic web for quite a long time now. I don't know what's new. But I did find it very interesting as I read along, like, who are some of the leading players in Web 3.0? So, does this mean anything to anybody?
Hillis.
Who is?
The
guy who wrote the book. Yeah, so apparently he's the founder of MetaWeb. I don't know what MetaWeb is, but apparently I should know because that's what people in the know, but I don't know. So, MetaWeb, I don't know what that is. I guess I can click on it and find out, but I'm afraid to. So I'm not going to do that. Barney Pell was a guy who, did I go to grad school with him? He knows everybody I went to grad school with, so he always says hello to me at the at conferences and things. He has a company called PowerSet, which, again, he won't tell me what it does, so I don't know. Nova Spivak, I don't know who that is. But, Barney Pell is one of these interesting people. I don't know if you are this kind of person or if you know this kind of person, but he's got, if he was on Facebook or that sort of thing, he would have 8,000 friends. I mean, he knows everybody. He keeps track of everybody. Whenever he has a party at his house, he invites like 800 people. Of course, some of these people are in other countries and don't really need to go to San Francisco to go to his party, but he's just one of these people that needs to be connected to everyone. And it's weird that now he's starting to show up in random blogs, you know, New York Times blogs. But anyway, so I thought that was interesting. It's probably more interesting if you know Barney Pell, but it is somewhat interesting given that you know who Gary Pell is. Okay then. Anybody else seen anything interesting in the world related to computers? Okay then. All right. Any other issues I should know about before we get distracted and talk about bigger questions? Anything else going on? Surely there must be something going on.
Midterms?
Yeah, so how are your other midterms going?
Killing them.
They're killing you?
Yes.
You're kidding?
No.
What year are you?
I'm senior.
You're senior?
Yes.
Is this different from previous semesters?
This seems more on the line. It's like, now do it or don't graduate.
Oh, I see. I see. Now it actually matters.
Yes.
Okay, I can see how that can change things a bit.
Sure, fair enough.
Well, so this, you know, in this class it should be really easy for me. I'm hoping for you as well. But like I said, I'm going to tell you the questions in advance. So how much easier can I think? I can tell you the answers in advance, right? That would. But anyway, well, I hope everybody's hanging in there. So when did the midterms kind of start to happen? Like last week, and it goes until
after Halloween.
Just keeps going. That's right. Yeah, sorry about that. All right, well, here's some questions that won't count for much, but But it should give you a chance to see if you actually follow the things that I talked about last time. So, let me get this started. So this is one of those one of these questions. I decided that I really want to win a raffle. Each day I enter a raffle, and this is a hypothetical situation. This is a raffle where you have a 1 in 100 chance of winning. So the probability is 1/100, right? 1%. On average, how many days must I play before I actually win this lottery? Each time I have a 1 in 100 chance of winning. So maybe I'll never win, but on average, it's going to take me some number of tries before I win. Maybe one, maybe a billion. But on average, what does it turn out to be? Ticket again on average. This is similar to the previous question. The question is it similar enough that it has the same answer? I give you the same choices. So the class as a whole didn't think these two questions had the same answer, though there could have been some people who gave the same answer to both of them. Let's do the first one first, and then we'll do the second one second. Yesterday, I'm jogging along, minding my own business, and then I tripped. I still wasn't able to figure out what I tripped on. There was like a tiny little crack, but I don't know. Anyway, falling at the ground at high speed, and I decide I'll save myself from getting all scraped up, so I rolled. Like, I did it like a dive roll. It was like a total stunt, movie stunt. And now my shoulder really hurts. This was much better when I was younger. Now that I'm in my 40s, my body doesn't want to do that anymore. So anyway, writing on the board, it's like, sorry about that. All right, so I'm going to point just like this. Just know that I would like to point more. All right, so what's happening here? So on each day, you have a 1 in 100 chance of winning. Then, if you win, you're done. Otherwise, the next day, you still have a 1 in 100 chance of winning. Right? You just wasted a day. But anyway, the process just continues over and over like that. We talked about that case last time. We said that if the probability of winning is P, then the average number of days, average is in a palette here, the average number of days is going to be 1 over P. So the probability in this case is 1 over 100. So the average number of days, the average number of trials before you get what you want is going to be 1 over that or 100. So that's answer D, which was the majority answer, but there was some people who thought 50 and 200. Thankfully, nobody thought 1 100, because that does seem a little bit weird. What more to say about that? It is very important that this is an average, because what's the maximum number of times that I might have to be in the lottery before I win? There's no maximum, right? No matter how long I've lost, I can continue to lose. There could be one more day that I lose. In fact, there's reasonable probability that I would lose another day. So there is no upper bound, but if you actually average it, the length of the run multiplied by its probability, added up over all possibilities, you get 100. Now, this question is similar, but not quite the same. So let's think about day one. So day one, we've got 100 folders laid out, and we're going to pick one at random. What's the probability that we'll get the one that has the train ticket in it?
1 out of 100.
1 out of 100. It's the same as in the lottery case. Okay. So in some sense, if I check it and it's empty, and I put it back down, and now the next day I still have the same 100 folders, and I'm going to try this again, it's just like the lottery question. But I changed it. I said, when I check it has the train ticket, and then I put it aside. If the folder's empty, I put it in a stack and don't look at it again, because I know that one doesn't have the train ticket in it. You can't do that with lottery, with a raffle, right? But you can do that if you're actually searching through a set of things. Now, what's the maximum number of days before I find the train ticket?
99.
Or actually, it could be on the 100th day.
Oh, after you put the...
Oh, yeah, but from the beginning, it could be 100. Right, so it's 99 after I put the first one aside. 100 total, so it can't go past 100. So what is it going to be on average? Well, I might get lucky and it'll be in the first couple, or I might get unlucky and it'll be in the last couple, but, on average, it's going to be near the middle. That's informal. We could do this mathematically, but I'm not sure that you really care. Yeah?
If you wanted to do it mathematically...
Some people will care. Then you add up the problem. Right, so what happens? So the first day, I pick at random, and let's say I miss. I had a 1 in 100 chance, and I missed. I put that folder aside. Now the second day, right, get out of bed. I come back to my folders, and now, what's my chance of getting the train ticket?
1 in 99,
because now there's only 99 possibilities, and one of them is the right answer. So now my odds are going up slowly, but they do go up. And in fact, after 50 days, now my chances are up to 1 in 50. And after 99 days, my chances are up to 1 in 2, right, 50%. Be sad to be that unlucky, but nevertheless, it can happen. So, right, so if we were trying to figure out what does it actually turn out to be, we would need to say, what's the probability of each possible length? What's the probability I get it on the first try, on the second try, on the third try, on the fourth try, and so on? And then I have to mathematically average all those together, which I could write a little program to do, actually. That wouldn't be so hard. Or I could do it algebraically. I could work it out symbolically. I didn't do that in advance, and I'm not sure that algebra is a good spectator sport. I'm not sure you want to watch me figure this out. But if you'd like, I'll be ready for that on Wednesday. But anyway, intuitively, what does it feel like the answer ought to be? You're equally likely to fall anywhere from the first day to the 100th day. So roughly, you'd expect it to be in the middle, like 50 days. Or it's not going to be 100. It can't possibly be 200. It's not going to be less than one day, or even a little more than one day. So really, there's only one choice that sort of logically fits. But it turns out to be exactly right. That really, on average, you're going to have to search through half of the list, half of the folders, before you finally get on the right one. Now remember, that doesn't mean that every time you're going to go halfway through and find it in the middle. It just means on average. Sometimes you're early, sometimes you're late, but it's going to average to the middle. Okay? So these are two different sort of things. In one case, we're sampling, this is a terminology that people use, you're sampling with replacement. Like in the raffle case, each time we come to it, it's same number of choices or chances as the time before. But then, in this case, we're sampling without replacement. What that means is that we check the folder, and if it's empty, we never check it again. We don't replace it back into the pile of possibilities. And you get two different answers. In one case, the average is you have to search the whole set on average. And in this case, you only have to search half. Which, again, intuitively makes sense, right? If you keep searching the same place over and over again, you're going to be wasting your time. Any questions on that? I might want to use this in some way when we analyze some algorithms later. It's sort of nice to have in your head that if you've got a random list, the thing you're looking for, if assuming it's in the list, is going to be around the halfway mark. All right. We also looked a little bit about how do we write a tiny little program in Scratch that picks random numbers in a certain range. I just want to make sure that you kind of get this idea. So Scratch doesn't have parentheses, but I don't know if you can see it. There's actually little blocks on top of other blocks. You see that? You get the order of operation from that. So we've got a pick random 0 to 1, there's a multiply by 4, and there's an add 7, but you have to actually look at the way that the little bubbles overlap to know which ones happen before which others. In fact, in this case, I guess it's the natural order of operations. But in general, you have to pay attention to the shapes of the blocks. So after we run this, A can be more than one possibility. What are the possible values that A can have after we've run this statement in Scratch? If it was a 0, now it's a 7. If it was a 4, it's now 11. So the two possible values that A could have after we execute this are 7 and 11. 7 and 11. It was a convenience store joke. Alright, so, and that was D, in fact. Okay? Anything to clarify on that? Is that alright? I think it's easier to go in this direction than if I said, give me a statement that could either be 7 or 11. So we can take on those two values. Right. To do that, you actually have to kind of figure out, all right, well, it starts off as a bit, and how much do we need to multiply it by, and what do we need to add to it? But in this case, I'm just asking you to go kind of the easy direction. You start off with a random bit, multiply it by 4, add 7. So it's either a 1, in which case you get 4 plus 7 is 11, or it's a 0, in which case you get 0 plus 7 is 7. Yeah?
Will you ever have to make a statement like that for this to that'll produce a certain amount, like, say, produce 7, 11? And not start with 0 or 1? Does it ever require starting with...
Well, so Scratch lets you can say pick random 7 to 11, right? Those are little blobs, and you can fill them with other values. I was just doing random bits, but Scratch is more powerful than that. So we can put... What if we did that? What if we said pick random 7 to 11? Then it could be 7, it could be 11, but it will also possibly be any other value in between. You can get 8 or 10. But that's not what you were asking. I just used it as an opportunity to talk. What was the question?
No, the question is that for this one, you're trying to produce 7s and 11s.
Yes.
If you had to produce some other numbers,
yeah.
Would there ever be a circumstance where you would not be able to pick random 0 and 1 to start with.
Oh. No, it's completely general. We can always make it out of zeros and ones. They're bits. Yeah, sometimes it's tricky, though. If we wanted something like 1, 13, or 97, those are the three possibilities. Well, then we need at least two random bits. And the scaling, we may have to do weird things with squaring and so forth, but that's...
But you can always start,
you can always start with bits. Yeah. Remember, when we needed to pick a random number 0, 1, or 2, three possibilities, we had to stick a little loop around it to throw out some of the values to make sure they were uniform. But we still just were generating random bits. Yeah, we can always do that. Bits are very general. Okay. Great. So let's pop back into the lecture from last time and make sure that some of this other random stuff makes sense to you. So this is the main thing that we talked about last time was if an event has probability P, then it takes 1 over P tries before it happens on average. So this is that. Same thing as the raffle ticket, the same thing as the how many times do you have to make a baby before you get a girl on average, that stuff. All right. There's other sorts of situations. Oh, the other one that's not on this list that I just mentioned, but I would like you to know, is that if you have a list of N items, and you're going to run through the list looking for one of the items, on average you have to go through N over 2, so half of the list, before you find what you're looking for. Here's another weird one, though. This is called the coupon collecting problem. So imagine that there's N coupons, and once you get all N of them, then you can take them to a store and get a free box of Rice Krispies or something. And let's just say that they're all equally likely. So each time you get one of these coupons, it's going to be one of the numbers from 1 to N. You in the beginning, you're going to get a new ticket right away, right? The first time you get one of these coupons, it's going to be one that you didn't have because you didn't have any. But the second time, there's some chance that you actually get a repeat. And so little by little, it's going to take you at least N coupons before you get all N unique coupons. But you may have had to get some repeats along the way. And it turns out that it ends up being about N times the natural log of N on average before you actually get all the coupons. We didn't talk about logs so much. I think there might be a slide with logs. Let me just flash it out. No, there's a box. Anybody seen the notes? I'm glad you read that. Okay, read that. All right, that must be wrong. Sorry. So, in computer science, log base 2 comes up a lot. Log base 2 of a number is the number of times you have to take that number and divide it in half before you get something that's less than 1. Right? So if you start off with a number like 16, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. So 4 times we have to divide it before we got something that's 1 or less. And so the log of base 16 is 4. In this case, exactly 4. 1,000. Try that. 1,000, 500, 250, 125, 60-something. Help me. 64-ish? 65? Call it 64. 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. 10. Log base 2 of 1,000 is 10, about. It's actually a little less. All right? And so this comes up. Do you remember when you were doing the South Park guy thing, and you start off with 16 of these critters, and it takes 4 guesses to get down until you know exactly which one it is? That's because each time you cut it in half. It's the log of 16. If I had given you 128 South Park people, then if you'd done it right, it would have taken you 7 guesses. 128, 64, 32, 16. And so the log base 2 of 128 is 7. So that's what logs are. All right, anyway, we'll see them coming up again later. Here it is. If we start with the number N, it was right on the screen, and I was begging for your help. It was right here behind me. If we start with the number N, we can cut it in half log N times before 1 is reached, 1 or smaller. Okay, so that's what logs are about. And they do come up. For example, let's say, I had a nice example of this, but I think it's probably not worth going. I think that was it for the probabilities. They're going to come up. I'm going to flash them by you again when we do sorting algorithms, because there's some sorting algorithms that actually do random things while they're running, and that helps them actually sort faster by being a little bit random. And that's kind of a neat idea, that actually being random can sometimes be a good thing. Oh, can anybody think, there's actually some very nice examples in your regular life where the better you are at being random, the better you are at what it is you're trying to do. Can anybody think of an example like that? It's sort of weird, but there are, it usually involves other people.
Circus?
Circus freak show. No, I don't mean that kind of random. I mean being unpredictable. Not just weird. What do you think?
You know, when you pick a password for...
So that's a good example. Right, if you want to protect yourself and make up a password, if you can't be really random, if you're very predictable and you always choose the same thing, you probably get broken into. I was thinking sports. Did anybody watch the football game last week? It's kind of cool. Anybody remember an example where they did something that seemed very random and it paid off? What's that?
Faking the field goal.
Faking the field goal. I was thinking of there was a faking of a touchdown. No, they don't fake the touchdown. They actually got the touchdown. But they did it by, is that what you mean? So it looked like they were going to shoot through a field goal. But right. So the guy, the center, was a covert quarterback. Do you guys watch it? I mean, I'm not a big sports fan, but I've been enjoying watching Rutgers because, you know, I work at Rutgers. Are we all into this or not? I don't have to use this as an example if you don't like. Once upon a time, I taught at Duke. At Duke, everyone's completely insane about basketball. And so one day, like, nobody in my class showed up. And I asked the people who did show up, where is everybody? And they said, they're waiting in line for tickets. You should know that. What are you, an idiot? Right? They didn't use those words. But it was like, they're tempting. I'm like, what does that mean? They're waiting in line for tickets, you idiot. And so I never, you know, I at least understood the interest. You don't have that kind of interest. Okay, then, moving on. So it turns out that pitchers, when they throw in baseball, and they hurt their shoulder. So if they always throw the same kind of pitches, or they throw according to a very predictable pattern, batters can be ready, and they can hit the ball very far. It turns out that the pitchers who are most successful are the ones who can mix up and be completely unpredictable about what kind of pitch they're throwing. Of course, it helps to be really accurate and fast, but given that, you should be that and unpredictable. So being random can really help fool your opponent. And so in some cases, algorithms are actually trying to fool their opponents. They're trying to do really well no matter what the data looks like. So we'll talk about an example like that, and I'll do some more analysis. But for today, we're going to talk about self-contradiction. All right. Ready? So here's the first. Let's start off doing this on the right foot. My only piece of advice for today, don't listen to any advice I give you today because it will hurt your head. Okay? Including this advice. Don't listen to this because you really need to pay attention. All right? So this is good. You gotta think a little sideways today. All right? I'm not going to be asking detailed questions about, take this bit, change this bit, whatever. Mostly for the next block of time, I'm just going to say really weird things that you have to think about it in two different ways at the same time. Like in this case, you have to think about the fact that what I'm telling you to do is actually contradicting the fact that I'm telling you to do it. So you have to think about what I said and what it means and how it reflects back on what I said. And as long as you can think sort of weird, upside down like that for a little bit, you'll get something out of this. Otherwise, you'll think that I'm just being goofball. All right. So why are we, other than the fact that it's sort of fun and puzzly to do this sort of thing, why do we care? Well, it turns out that interesting things happen when something is allowed to refer to itself. So when I said, don't listen to any advice, including this advice, the statement is actually referring to itself. And as soon as you can do that, as soon as you can make a statement that can assert something about itself, it can actually negate its own existence. And you can use that to prove interesting things about the world. So let's start off really mild. Oxymorons. So let's talk about oxymorons for a little bit. So this is a list that I got off the web. If you can believe it, www.oxymoronlist.com. And so these are all phrases of two words where, at least on the surface, the words contradict each other. So government, organization. Alone, together. Let's be alone together. Personal computer. Silent stream. Living dead. Now you're living dead. Is it living or is it dead? Same difference. Tape live before a studio audience. Plastic glasses.
Tight slacks. Right? What does slack mean?
Loose.
Peace Force. You win Peace Force. Pretty ugly. Hey, bud. Work vacation. Tax return. Tax return. Virtual reality.
Is that real?
Dodge Ram. Dodge Ram. Right, this is a car, but it's got those two meanings in it. Hey, let's go have a work party. I would like some jumbo shrimp. Looks like a healthy tan. And of course, Microsoft Word. So I just thought it was funny. I didn't make this list up. But what's interesting about this is all these examples put two words together that have incongruous meanings, but they actually all make sense, right? Jumbo shrimp means pretty big for a shrimp. It doesn't mean that it's both big and small at the same time. So it doesn't really contradict itself. So there is sort of a contradiction, but it's not very deep. But there are things that people say sometimes that actually have much deeper self-contradictory natures to it. So these are all things that I've actually heard people say, right? So a person looked at me and said, "We are not effing bitter." Okay, but somehow the way you said that means that I think you are effing bitter. I am not in denial. I'm not. Eschew obfuscation. This is said humorously, right? This means avoid overly complex language, but said in an overly complex way. When you least expect it, expect it. Well, but then if I expect it, then I won't be the least expecting it anymore. So this really doesn't make any sense. People do say that. But I don't speak English. But you just did! Stop that. I'm not talking to you. Well, of course you are. You just said that to me. I can't talk right now. People on the phone. I can't talk right now. No, but you just did. That's not okay. I'm sorry, but I just don't care. Well, then you're not really sorry. Leave me be. I'm asleep. I'm speechless. I prefer not to have an opinion. Well, that's an opinion right there. As a general rule, we handle everything on a case-by-case basis. I actually heard someone say this, and they meant it completely straight-faced. That's not a general rule if you handle everything on a case-by-case basis. It's handling everything on a case-by-case basis. And I told you he's unpredictable. Well, then he's predictable. You just predicted what he was going to do. This isn't quite something that somebody said, but okay, people know what okay is. Apparently, that stands for all correct, which is completely incorrect, right? Because all doesn't start with O and correct doesn't start with K. But apparently, in 1939, this is when they first started using it. That's what it meant. It's just funny. Don't let me pressure you. You're pressuring me. So anyway, so people do say these sort of weird self-contradictory things. Some people, these are all quotes from comedians, where they actually do this specifically to be funny. You know what I hate most? Rhetorical questions. They all laughed when I said I was going to be a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now. I love that one. Because, like, they should be laughing now. All right. If there's anything the nonconformist hates worse than a conformist, it's another nonconformist who doesn't conform to the prevailing standards of nonconformity. Which I don't think is very funny. Emo Phillips. You know what I hate? Indian givers. No, I take that back. Last month I blew $5,000 on a reincarnation seminar. I figured, hey, you only live once. Okay, but if you believe that, then why are you wasting money on a reincarnation seminar? And then Stephen Wright, like his whole comic style, not whole, but a lot of it is all weird self-reference stuff. I almost had a psychic girlfriend, but she left me before we met. Plan to be spontaneous tomorrow. I'd kill for a Nobel Peace Prize. I was trying to daydream, but my mind kept wandering. He just stands there. He delivers it a lot better than I do. You know Steve Wright, right? Stephen Wright? Yes? No? He just stands there. He's completely deadpan. Like, I really like my dental hygienist. So I eat a box of Oreos before I go. Anyway, stuff like that. But a lot of the jokes had this kind of weird twist to them. Here's some pictures, which I call Untitled, which of course is the title, by Anonymous, which of course is the who it's by. So this is a famous painting by Magritte that says in French, can everybody read that? Yeah.
This is not a pipe.
Yeah, it says underneath the pipe, this is not a pipe.
But it's a
he was a very twisted guy. But you know, some people say, oh, but what he means is it's a picture of a pipe. Okay. No name. This is the exit here for No Name. Anybody know who that is? It's Clint Eastwood, but you know who he's being in this movie? He was younger then. The Man with No Name. That's his name. Sometimes people, a lot of computer manuals will have this space intentionally left blank. But they'll write it in the space, like it'll actually print it there. This space intentionally left blank. But it's not blank anymore, you just wrote on it. Keep door closed at all times. That's not much of a door then, is it? It's like, let this be a wall. That's what they say, keep door closed at all times. The Neverending Story 2. Really? How did we get there? That's a real movie. And there's no like, oh, whoops, maybe we shouldn't call it that anymore. Sure. There's nothing which cannot be improved. Change it to that. Actually, this came, what was it in? It was like a, was it a robot? Do you remember last year, Monica? This is a piece of packaging that was in something that I bought. And it says on it, I got a picture of it, discard before using. I don't know how to do that. How can I use it? Once I discard it, I can't use it. It made me very sad. All right, let's see. Last one. We talked about Scratch and Python, a bunch of computer languages. All computer languages have a way, not all, almost all, let's say all, have a way of actually putting stuff in the program that the computer is not for the computer's benefit. It's for whatever person is reading it. And they're called comments. So you can have the text, the instructions that the computer actually should run, but then you can put comments in it as well. And the language C, and I think also the language C++, the way that you tell the program, the compiler, to ignore the text, because it's just for people, is you put slash star and star slash around it, like weird parentheses. And so this is a t-shirt that you can buy that says no comment on it, but it's in comment markers, in C comment markers. So it is a comment. It's a no comment. The comment is the no comment, but it actually is a comment, but it isn't no comment. It's a comment that says no. So that's sort of twisted. All right, so a visual example. Escher drew a lot of stuff that was kind of self-referent in some ways. I modified it a little bit. I found a different picture and I stuck them together. But this is a hand that's drawing a hand, and what that other hand is doing is erasing the first hand. Right? So that's kind of annoying, right? Because actually, the real Escher one is the hand is drawing a hand, which is sort of interesting and weird, but it's not self-contradictory. It's unclear how those hands came about in the first place, but now they're drawing each other. Here, the hand that's erasing is erasing the hand that's drawing the hand that's erasing. So if it's successful, if the erasing hand is successful, it will erase the hand that is drawing the erasing hand, and so the erasing hand will cease to be. So then it can't erase the other hand, so the other hand actually exists. So this is actually a pictorial version of almost all the arguments that are coming next. A lot of the stuff that I've been showing you are sort of cute and funny, but they're actually not nonsensical. This is where we're getting to the really mathematically interesting nonsense. Or, to use an oxymoron, some serious fun. So here's the idea. There's a weird idea. You shouldn't be able to create a statement or something in the world that, if it existed, if interpreted correctly, it results in another statement that negates the original statement. Okay? It's sort of like this idea that you see in science fiction sometimes, where you can go back in time and kill your own grandfather. Right? So, you know, you go and you kill the grandfather, and of course now the grandfather doesn't exist, so then your parents couldn't exist, and then you couldn't exist, so you couldn't kill the grandfather. So the grandfather exists, so you exist, so you have the gun, so you can kill the grandfather. Something's wrong here, right? This is called a time paradox. And the thing about a time paradox is it can't possibly exist, because if it could exist, you can have this situation where a person is and is not at the same time. And so we're going to use that. So here's a survey of some other things that you may have heard in other classes, not actually relevant to this class, but I feel like it's stuff that maybe you should know. So here's famous Russell's paradox, as delivered by me. So in the town of Kelm, there's a barber. His job is to shave every man in town who does not shave himself. Okay? So that means that so some people shave themselves, everyone else, the barber has to shave the person. But now, who shaves the barber? Assuming the barber's in the town, barber's a person in the town, if the barber shaves himself,
then he's not allowed to shave that person, because he only shaves people who don't shave themselves. So he's not allowed to shave himself. But if he doesn't shave himself, then the barber has to shave him, which is himself. So he has to shave himself. But he can't shave himself, because if he were to, right, so it goes around and around and around like this, which is kind of a bizarre, weird example, and of course, what's the problem here?
Can't the barber just have a beard?
The barber could, yes. So there's a couple very clever ways out of it. That's one of them. Can anybody think of any other way of doing it?
But it doesn't make sense, because, all right, the barber doesn't shave himself, and he needs to shave himself in order to not need to shave
yes.
himself.
Yes!
So he, in order to, this statement doesn't, like, really work as it, because, look, he has to actually do the whole thing in order to not have to shave himself, so it couldn't work, kind of.
I see. No, but it's like, each morning, everyone has to decide, do you shave yourself, or does the barber shave you? You can only be one. It's before the shaving actually happens. But one, so one trick, and gentleman with a beard suggests that maybe the barber should just have a beard. Simplify it. Anybody else who doesn't have a beard have a suggestion? Maybe somebody who can't grow a beard? Maybe the barber is a woman. That works. Oh. Now, I use the barber, his job. I did kind of give it away. But that's one way out of this paradox. Had I phrased it differently, the barber's a woman. The barber doesn't live in a town. That's another one. You have,
I don't know. Maybe the barber is only a barber while he's shaving other people.
Right. And we sort of tinker with what we think barber means or when this statement actually holds true. But the point of this, so Russell was a mathematician. The point of this was he was not actually a cosmopolitanist. What's the word? Cosmetologist. That doesn't sound right. Cosmetology. He wasn't like someone who does hair and makeup and nails and stuff. He was a mathematician. He was making a deep mathematical point. So,
where I have an exposition of the point.
Yeah. So in particular, he was arguing against what was called naive set theory. So set. Remember sets. Everybody must have done sets at some point in math class. That says set is a collection of objects, right? So you can have a set of all the people in the room, or you can have a set of all colleges in the Big East, or you can define various kinds of sets. But if you're really twisted, sort of outside of like high school level, you might start saying, can I define sets that refer to themselves? If you're allowed to make sets any way you want, why not? Say, I would like to make a set that consists of all other sets except those that contain themselves. That's my rule. That's the set I want. Can that set exist? And the answer is, not really, because you can't answer the question, is that set in that set? Because if it is, it isn't, and if it isn't, it is. It's just like the barber thing, except it's for the mathematical side. And what Russell came out with is he said, all right, in naive set theory, we can define things that are completely logically broken. And therefore, there's a problem with naive set theory. We need to regenerate the basis of mathematics on a set theory that doesn't have broken things in it. And so that's what he ended up doing. So he used this notion of self-contradiction, self-reference, to say, we need to overhaul mathematics to make it make sense again. And he did.
And it's pretty amazing.
All right, here's another classic one. This is from Gödel, Kurt Gödel, which is a picture of him standing with some random guy. I'm not sure who the other guy is. You know who the other guy is?
No.
It's Einstein. All right, they were buddies. And you know what? Can you guess where they are? What state they're in? What's that?
New Jersey.
New Jersey, indeed. I thought somebody said Princeton, which is actually more accurate, but not correct to the question of what state we're thinking. So the two of them worked together in Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study. And Einstein really liked Gödel. And as flaky as Einstein was, Gödel was so much flakier that Einstein actually followed him around and kept him out of trouble. But Gödel was a crazy, brilliant man. And one of the things he did is he showed that within mathematics, you can write down a mathematical statement that means the following. This statement that I'm making right now cannot be proven within mathematics. So what's the weird thing about this? The weird thing about this is that if it's true, you can't prove that it's true. Because if you could, then it would be false. It says, it asserts of itself, I cannot be proven. So if it's true, it can't be proven. On the other hand, if it's false, that means this statement can be proven, which means that you now prove something that's false. And that would mean that all of mathematics is broken. So as soon as you have a mathematical system that's complicated enough to include the whole numbers,
I think what happened is somebody stopped monitoring his iPod. Is that right? All right. We can work with that. So what he showed is if you, once you have a mathematical system that's complex enough that you can talk about the real numbers, the integers, like, or the whole numbers, 1, 2, 3, up, you know, infinity, like arbitrarily big sets like that, then you can actually express that statement. And therefore, there are things in mathematics that are true, but you can never prove them. No mathematician can prove them. Or mathematics is actually just fundamentally broken. One of those two things has to be true. And so it's kind of a rough choice. Is he distracting you guys? Should I help him with something? All right, so that's one argument. Here's another argument. Another really crazy, interesting, brilliant mathematician. Georg Cantor, I think was his name. So he asked the following question. How many fractions are there? You know, like number divided by number, like integer divided by integer. Infinite number, right? You can make any number of fractions you want. There's always more. How many decimals are there? Real numbers. Like point, da 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 da. Infinite of those two. So you might ask, are they the same size infinity? Now maybe you wouldn't ask this, but apparently this guy sat around and thought about questions like that. And it turns out that not a lot of people had really worked out what it means for infinities to be bigger than each other. And he was able to not only work that out, but show that in fact these are not the same size. That one of these is actually a bigger infinity than the other. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what it means for a set to be the same size first. So if we say there's 51 people with clickers in the class right now, and there's 51, I don't know, I have 51 coins in my bank, okay? The fact that they're the same number means that I could pair everything up. I could take each coin and assign it to one person. Each coin, assign it to one person. And at the end, every person has a coin, every coin has a person. They're the same size sets, okay? It's not weird and strange in when you think about integers because you think, okay, well, of course they're the same. They're both the same number. But what does it mean to talk about numbers that are infinitely big? So what Cantor said is, no, we're going to just generalize this idea. We're going to say two sets are the same size if we can make a one-to-one mapping, okay, between all the elements in one set and all the elements in the other, so that none of them are left out and nobody is assigned two partners. We're just pairing everything up. So, for example, which is a bigger set? All the integers, you know, 1 and up. What we call them natural numbers. Then all the natural numbers, 1 and up, versus all the even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16. Which of those two are bigger? It feels like the...
1 and up.
What's that?
1 and up.
This seems like there's twice as many, right? But they're both infinite, so you can't really have twice infinity.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. Like, infinity is infinity. It's defined by you're both endless. Whichever way you go, if you take 1 away from infinity, it's still infinity. It's a constant...
That's true, but what if you take infinity away from infinity? Like, things get weird.
Yeah.
But let's think through this one example. So think about the counting numbers, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. So this is one set of numbers. Some people call it natural numbers. And now let's look at the evens. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 15. And the way that we're going to define the size of infinite sets, we say two sets are the same size if you can map all the elements of one set to the other and back. Okay, you can pair them all up. Couple them and send them to the dates. Whatever. We want it so that every number in this list has a partner over here and vice versa. Okay? Can we do that? Well, it looks like you can based on the way that I drew this. But there's a general rule. The way to show that these are the same size sets is you have to tell me a rule that tells me how to map an element from this set to one in this set, and vice versa, so that they're all paired up. So who should who should we couple up the 6 with so that everybody's going to get a partner? Who should we pick? We can match up 6 and 6, right? That's one idea. So we can do that. 4 can go with 4. This is good. 2 can go with 2.
8 and 8.
Sure. Can do that. I mean, the list is infinitely long, so we don't want to go through the whole thing right now. Does this work? Does everybody get to go to the dance?
No.
No, the poor Oz here, it's always the Oz, right? The poor Oz don't get to go. So it looks like maybe there's more of these than these, but maybe we just didn't couple them up right. Maybe we need a better way of coupling them up. You see how to couple these guys up so that every even gets a natural number, every natural number gets an even.
Half its value. Every half is the even value.
So pair an even number with the half.
Yes.
Can you always do that with an even number?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's an even number, right?
That's what even numbers are. They're something that you can divide in half. So 8 goes with 4, 6 goes with 3, 4 goes with 2, 2 goes with 1, in this list 10 goes with 5, 12 goes with 6, and this continues forever. In fact, let's try this, right? I'll say, no, you left someone out. 43 in this list doesn't have a partner. And you'll say, yes, 43 does have a partner. It's 86. Oh, no, but in the even list, 100 doesn't have a partner.
50.
Yes, it does. It has 50. So everybody in this list gets a partner over here. Everybody in this list gets a partner over here. They're the same size set by this notion of size, by Cantor's notion of size, that you can map the two sets together. Right? So as long as you can list them and pair them up, they're the same size set. And it seems like any infinity is going to have this property. But now we want to talk about the set of all fractions. So to do this, it's helpful to kind of list them out. So here we go. Start with all the fractions where the numerator and the denominator add to 1, then 2, then 3, and so on. So here's a list of all the fractions. It's infinitely long, but I put a little dot, dot, dot at the end, so it's okay. So we'll put 0 over 1, then 0 over 2, 1 over 1, then 0 over 3, 1 over 2, then 0 over 4, 1 over 3, 2 over 2, then 0 over 5, 1 over 4, 2 over 3, right, so we're kind of going up the list so that the numerator and the denominator add up to a particular number. We just kind of step through them one at a time until we get to a number that's bigger than 1, and then we stop. So the next set of the list is 0 over 6, 1 over 5, 2 over 4, 3 over 3. We've done that block. 0 over 7, 1 over 6. So here's the question. Will every fraction appear on this list eventually? Well, again, with the going to the dance argument, we need to say, well, if that's true, then I should be able to give any fraction, and we should be able to tell where on the list it would be. And the answer is, yeah, we can actually do that. It's sort of irritating and complicated, but we know we're going to hit every fraction. Every element of the list will have a fraction. Every fraction will be somewhere in the list. Why? Well, so take a number like, 14 over 71. Okay, there's a fraction. Now remember, if we think about these as being listed in blocks, what block would this occur in? The blocks are the numerator and the denominator add up to a fixed number. So this will be in the block where the numerator and the denominator will add up to 85, and it's going to be the 14th in that block. Okay, because we're going to start with 0 over 85, 1 over 84, 2 over 83. We're going to list them all out until we get to 70, what do we get to? Like 40-something over 40-something else. 42 over 43. And then that list will be over. Okay? You with me? So any fraction you can give me, I can tell you where it will fall on the list. First, what block it's in is just whatever the numerator and the denominator are added up. And how far in that block is whatever the numerator is. So every fraction, any fraction you can tell me that's between 0 and 1, has a place to live in this lovely list. Okay? So we know that the infinity of fractions is just like the infinity of the evens or the counting numbers. They're the things that you can actually list up and put into positions on the list. Okay? So far so good. Here's the weird part. What about the decimals? Can we list all the decimals? I don't know, let's try. Here's a list of some decimals. We start off with 0.5795391657012365 4, and it keeps going. This is an infinitely long decimal expansion. Alright? That's the first element on our list. What about the second one? Oh sure. 0.98875
Anyway, you get the idea that, this list, we're going to try to list out all the decimals, one after another. And now the question has to be, is every decimal on this list? And the answer is no. No matter how you list out the decimals, I can always find one that's not on your list. How could I do such a thing? Well, here's the trick. Here's how this works. Do you see where I'm trying to go at this point? If I can prove that, no matter how you list out the decimals, there's always ones that aren't there, then you can't list them all. So there must be more of them than there are, say, fractions or even numbers or integers. Yeah?
Wait, so there has to be, in order for them to be on the list, there has to be a list which abides by some sort of rules, not just a list.
It doesn't have, no, I don't have to know what the rule is. I'm gonna say, you give me the list, and I'm going to tell you how to find something that's not on the list. I don't even care how the rule is. Yeah, it doesn't have to be generated with the rule.
But we're just working with infinity here, right? It has to be in that list of infinity, and it should be able to be proven that you can find it somewhere. But
yeah, if it were the case that the number of decimals, point blah, 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 between 0 and 1, were the same as the number of fractions, then it would also be the same as the number of integers. And so we should be able to list them out. Who gets paired with number 1? Who gets paired with number 2? Who gets paired with number 3? If they're the same size, then there's got to be some way of doing that. But you can't. You can't do it. Because you'll have to leave some off. And that's what I'll try to argue. What's getting left off? It's hard to... How can I tell you that without actually seeing the infinitely long list? Oh, here's the clever part. All right. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to read down... Take the list, any list at all, and read down the diagonal. Okay. Look at from the first element of the list, look at the first number past the decimal. The second element of the list, look at the second number past the decimal. The third element of the list, look at the third number past the decimal. Okay? Just reading down, how long is this list? It's an infinitely long list of digits. Okay? So, what do we know? So now what we're going to do, so that's just another fraction. Is that fraction on the list? It might be. I don't know. But I can tell you something that's not. Add 1 to each digit with wraparound. So the 0.58980324 67, we're going to turn that into 0.6. We add 1 to the 5. 9, add 1 to the 8. 0, add 1 to the 9 and wraparound. 9, add 1 to the 8. Right. So I'm taking that decimal and just and basically adding 0.111111 repeating to it. Oh, what is that number, by the way? Do you know that number? 0.1 repeating? 9. So just take whatever we got on the diagonal and add a 9 to it. But it's not quite that, because the 9 won't do the proper wraparound. But anyway, it's sort of like a 9. Oh, my friend just had an 8. Hang on a second. Hey, I'm in the lecture, but did you just have a baby? Congratulations. Everybody say congratulations. 1, 2, 3.
Congratulations!
Awesome, dude. All right, I'm going to go back to the lecture. Thanks. Bye. Thanks for calling. How cool is that? Alright, I wouldn't want to stop you guys just for anything, but that's kind of cool. Alright, anyway, back to this thought. So, we took the list, we extracted from it a decimal expansion, we altered it to get a new decimal expansion, and I will make the following claim. This new number, this 0.69091435 7 dot 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 dot, is not on the list. How do I know that? Can't it just be somewhere else on the list? Why can't it be on the list? It's different from every number on the list. Why? Well, how do we know that it's different from the first number on the list? Well, we know it's different from the first number on the list because the first digit of the expansion is 1 plus whatever the first digit of the expansion on the list was. Right? So the fact that it goes 0.6 means it doesn't match 0.5, whatever. So that's not it. Well, what about the second number? Maybe it's the second position. No, it's different from the second number in the second position. It's different from the third number in the third position. It's different from every number on the list at whatever position that number on the list is. So the thousandth, whatever, just list it out. It's the thousandth number on the list, which actually would be lower than this, in its thousandth place will have some digit. Our new number will have a different digit in that place. This number is not on the list.
Well, what is it like? There's no rules for defining the list, so
no.
So that's like it doesn't make sense. Like you,
there we go. Ahead, go ahead.
Like it's like, how can you know that it's not up there? There are no rules for defining the list.
Because I have a rule for defining my number, this new number, and that rule makes it so that that number is nowhere on the list. Such a list is impossible to construct. It can't be done. No, you can make a list, but you can't have every decimal in the list. You have to leave some out. There are too many of them.
Well, I don't get it. It's weird. It's like the list itself is not defined. Like, all right, you can, with decimals, you have an infinite amount of places.
That's right. That's right.
So in order to make a list, you have to narrow it down, unless you're going to go through all the possibilities on one set,
okay,
and go to the next amount of digits.
So in some sense, we agree, though, right? What we're saying is you can't list all the decimals.
Yeah.
That's the punchline. And you're saying, well, you can't list, this proof doesn't work because you can't list all the decimals. Okay, well, we agree, though. You can't list all the decimals. There's too many of them.
Well, I'm saying, like, for this list, I'm saying there's no rules for the list exactly, for, like, the list itself. So
sure.
How can you then say that number's not on the list? Since there are no corresponding rules.
Right. Well, if there were a way to make such a list, then I can do my trick, which says that there can't be such a way to make a list. But we can make a list of all decimals. No, we can make a list of decimals. Like the fractions that I listed before, we can list them out, right? The 0 over 0. So the first element would be point all zeros. The next one was 0 over 1, so that would be the same again. The next one was 0 over 2. The one after that was 1 over 1, which is 1 point and then all zeros. So each of the fractions can be turned into a decimal. So we can make an infinitely long list of decimals according to a rule. That's not hard. I'm just saying that whatever rule you come up with, you're going to leave stuff off.
So that's what that's what I get to set limits for.
Say it again?
So that's what that guy was talking about. He just set limits for something so that it doesn't repeat itself.
You mean Cantor?
Yeah.
No, which guy? Somebody up here?
No.
The guy I mentioned before. So, you mean like Russell. Russell said you can't make arbitrary sets.
Yeah.
And this is sort of like you can't make an arbitrary list.
Yeah.
Maybe. But really all it's saying is there's more fractions than there are decimals. So that the punchline of all this is there actually is at least two different kinds of infinities. He had a whole theory with an infinite number of different infinities, but it turns out there's only two that anyone have actually discovered naturally. And those are the counting numbers, things you can list. They're also called the countably infinite. And then there's this, the continuum, where you actually have infinite decimal expansions. That's a pretty freaky thing to do. And the way that this works, this diagonalization argument, is a kind of self-contradiction. When we define this number for the list, the way we define it is by finding something in the list and making it contradict it. The general form of this is called a diagonalization argument. Because, you know, diagonal. You can't make a list of all the decimals, you can make a list of all the fractions. There's more decimals, real numbers, than there are fractions. Alright. So now, none of that is computer science. It's all sort of fun math games, but it's not computer science. There is a really important piece of computer science that's based on this idea of self-contradiction. So that's what I'd like to introduce. So to do that, let's start off looking at some scratch scripts. So each of these scripts counts I backwards from 10 to 1, so pop 10 times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I think I actually showed you all of these maybe two classes ago. All right, so that's fine. There's a bunch of different ways of writing the same thing. But here's the question. Is there some way that we can change what I is set to, and otherwise don't change what this says, so that the script will actually run forever? It will never stop. Well, the first script, let's look at the first one. The first one says, no, let's look at the second one. The second one says, you set I to 10, then you repeat, however big I is, you repeat I times, pop, and decrease I. So whatever I starts at, that's the number of times it's going to run. And since you can't set I to infinity, this can only run a finite number of times. So this the second one will not loop forever, no matter what we initially set I to. Let's look at this one. This one says, you set I to 10, and then you loop forever. Oh, it looks like maybe we could loop forever. Here's what it does. If I is less than 1, it stops running. Forever ends. Otherwise, it pops and it decreases I by 1. So what about this guy? So if we start it with a really big number, it will eventually count down, get to 0, and stop. If we start it with a really small number, like negative 50 or something like that, what is it going to do? It's going to test I is less than 1, negative 50 is less than 1, so it's just going to stop right away. So either it's going to pop the number of times that I is, or it's going to stop right away. So this won't run forever, even though it has a forever in it. But now let's look at the first one. First one says, we start I at 10, and we keep repeating until I hits 0, we keep repeating pop and make I 1 smaller. Which sounds very reasonable, as long as I is something like 10. What if I is 0? Well, repeat until I equals 0. It starts off at 0, so it'll stop right away. What if I is negative 2? Well, let's see. Repeat until I equals 0. So it's not, it's negative 2. It's going to pop, and then it's going to decrease I by 1. It'll go from negative 2 to negative 3. Then it goes back up to the top of the loop. Is it 0? No. So it pops and decreases it. Now it's negative 4. Is it 0? No. So it pops and decreases it. Now it's negative 5. When is this going to stop? When I hit 0. When is I going to hit 0? It won't. So this, there are some things that we can set I to so that this program, this script, will actually loop forever, never stopping. Never stopping. So which of these is the worst? Right? So of these scripts, and they all work when I set to 10, but the first one actually does something horrible if I is negative. So you want to watch out for that. So one of the ways that you can say this is that program, you can set I to a value so that this program never halts. It never stops running. So we're going to use this word halt a couple times. That's what it means. You stop running, be done with whatever it was just doing. So here, given that things can halt or not halt, we can define a halting problem. A halting problem, this sort of looping forever is actually one of the most annoying classes of programming errors, and anybody who's written any program of any complexity has done this by accident. So it would be really nice if there was some kind of tool that could look at your program, read it through, and say, you know, if you set I to a negative number, this is going to run forever. Right? There are values that you could set. You could change this, and it would actually run forever. Maybe you should write it a different way. So what we'd like is a piece of code, a program, a subroutine. We'll call it halt, and here's what it does. It takes the program as input and returns true if the program always halts, no matter how I is initially set, and false if there are some input that will make it loop forever. So this program is basically declaring your code is safe, or it's saying your code is unsafe. There's something that you can do to it that will actually make it run forever. That would be a great thing to have. All right? Now, in Scratch, you can't actually feed a program to a program in Scratch, but most other programming languages you can. Scratch is a little too simplistic for that, so bear with me, at least imagine that you could, instead of assigning a value to a variable that's always a number, you can imagine assigning a value to a variable that is a program, a string, say, a list of letters. And so such a thing, you can imagine such a program happening. And if you could imagine such a thing happening, then you could imagine using it for something. So here's what you could use it for. We're going to write a new program called Halt Tester. Oh, halt tester is the halt thing that I just mentioned before. After it's done, it sets a variable result to 1 if the program always halts, and 0 if it can go into an infinite loop. Alright, that's fine. But if this halt tester exists, then we can write a new program called contrary, and it does this. It's an ornery program. So it says, alright, we're going to start off. There's some program that we want to test. It's stored in the variable prog. And if it is this program, if it's contrary, then we're going to do the following. First, call halt tester to see if this program always halts. If it does, if the result of calling halt tester is 1, then it goes into an infinite loop popping. But on the other hand, if halt tester says that the program that it was called on halts for some inputs, doesn't halt. Right. 1 means it halts. 0 means it can go into an infinite loop. Then this will just terminate. It'll just finish right away. All right? So that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But here's the problem. What does contrary do if prog is set to contrary? What if it refers to itself? It asks the halting subroutine, do you halt or do I halt? It says, do I halt? And the halt subroutine either says yes or no. If it says, yes, you halt. You always stop no matter what your input is. Then it goes into an infinite loop. Like, you know, it's this sort of thing, right? Right? Do I always halt? Yes, I always halt. I'm going into an infinite loop. Biting, like that. All right? On the other hand, if it says, hey, do I go into an infinite loop? And it says, yes, you do. Then it says, that's very interesting, and it stops right away. It just does the opposite of whatever it's told. If you've ever babysitted, you've experienced this sort of thing, right? This program just does the opposite of what it's told. And so what's the problem here? The problem here is that we asserted that there could be a program that could tell whether or not all other programs always halt or if they don't always halt. If that existed, we can create this contradictory situation, a program that halts if it doesn't halt, and doesn't halt if it halts. It's allowed to do the opposite. So that can't be. So what the problem here is, there can't be something that solves the halting problem. If there was such a thing, we could create this self-contradiction. So there can't be such a thing. There can't be a program that can tell if all other programs halt. And so we say that this problem is incomputable. In other words, there can be no program that implements this idea. There can be no program that always can tell if all other programs halt. It would lead to a contradiction, like the Barber paradox, like a lot of these cases. So, all right, that's sort of weird, but I made a... Okay, yeah, go ahead.
You can't have that program because that program itself can't be tested to see whether...
We can use that program as a subroutine to make a new program that has an indeterminate halting value. So, basically, like if I could tell you what you were going to do 30 seconds from now, you could ask me, and I'd tell you, and you can make yourself do the opposite. So what's the problem here? The problem is, I can't tell you what you're going to do 30 seconds from now.
I don't see the connection.
No? So this is the halt tester is a program that can tell whether or not another program is going to always stop. It tells it what the program is going to do. And so a program that actually asks, hey, what am I going to do, can then force itself to do the opposite. So you can't write a program that can tell what other programs are going to do.
How can a program force itself to do the opposite?
Of what this other program thought it would do, not of what it actually did. It can't simultaneously do the opposite of what it actually does. But it's asking this halting. So the first thing is we're saying, let's imagine that there is, it's like an oracle. Like we go over and we say, oh great halting solver in the sky, what will this program do? And it says, it will always halt. Or no, it will sometimes go into an infinite loop. That seems fine until you say, oh great halting problem in the sky, what do I do? Because if I can ask the halting solver what I do, then I have free will. I can do whatever I choose. So the problem is it can't tell me what I'm going to do. That's where it breaks down. The assumption that there could be something that could always predict what every other program is going to do can't be, because you can have programs that refer to themselves. Still not going all the way through. So I made a music video to try to make this easier to understand. I'm not sure, I suspect that it will not help in the least. But nevertheless, I did make it. So let me see if I can get it up on the screen here.
Wait, real quick. So we can make a program that can predict for some programs, but
yes.
Not all.
Yes. That is a way out. Yes.
Okay.
We can easily write programs that sometimes do the right prediction.
But cannot always.
But if you claim that it does it for all programs, then I want to know what it's going to do for me, and I'm always going to choose to do the opposite of what you tell me I'm going to do. So, right, it's okay to say a program can sometimes figure this out. It just can't always figure it out.
What if the halting program survives so that it knows that you're going to do the opposite?
Yeah, but then, sure, right, if it somehow can tell enough of the future to know what the... But then it has to give an answer. And the answer can be reversed. So, if I know that you know that I know that you know, it has to end with something. Alright, I have a good version of this, but I don't know how to access it. So, instead, I will just go directly to YouTube. But that's not going to work. Come on. Alright. The answer now. Thank you.
When a bold man sidles up to me with a grin and a gleam in his eye. He says, choose anyone at the bar tonight, and I'll make you this bet just for fun. Though it's not the default, some folks drink booze with salt, and I'll tell you if your pick is one. La da di da.
We paid a Holly in the summer. And the piano player me, the other department. Thank you. Maybe. Maybe, yeah. I mean, that's where things break down.